Welcome to Ag Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Association of Women in Agriculture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is vocally enhanced by the brothers of Alpha Gamma Rho. I'm Nathan.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Egg.
I'm Tyler.
I'm Marcus.
And I'm Galen.
We're excited to be taking over Ag Chat today to talk about the future of production agriculture and how we are going to feed a growing population.
Hey, I'm Egg. I'm an agronomy major here on campus. I'm a third year into college so far. Also in Badger Crops Club.
Yeah, I'm Hayden. I'm an undecided major. I'm a sophomore here. I'm in Dairy Science 472, which is a sustainability class right now. So I'm excited to bring a lot of what I've learned in that class to our conversation today.
Yeah, this is Nate. I grew up on a dairy farm in Cobb, Wisconsin. I'm a junior majoring in ag biz. I stay pretty involved in agriculture, through multiple clubs and stuff on campus, and have some beef cows and stuff back home too. So,
all right, again, I'm Tyler. I'm a sophomore here studying food sciences, and I have the combination background of raising dairy cattle and working on a potato farm.
And I'm Marcus, senior studying dairy science. I grew up showing cattle. Both grandparents did dairy farms, so have a little bit of experience there too.
And I'm Galen. I'm a senior majoring in dairy science, and I'm first generation off the farm, but excited to bring back some perspectives on working on a dairy with a methane digester.
So we're going to kind of start off by just kind of talking about the growing need to feed people on planet Earth, specifically 10 billion people by 2050. I'm going to let Hayden elaborate a little bit on what that looks like.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. So in my class right now, one of the first things we talked about was, by the year 2050, there's this projected, population growth of that will be at like 9 to 10-ish billion people by that year. So, our population is going to continue to grow. And there's still this problem that like 1 in 7 people still don't have access to sufficient protein or energy from their diets. That's both in like economically developed and developing countries. So there's, a conversation that needs to be had of what we're going to do in the ag industry to be able to support these people as, we plateau as a population on planet Earth.
Hey, do you have some reasons why 1 in 7 people still do not have access? Is it production issues or is it supply chain?
So there's kind of a few different things that go into that. A few, some of it is just these countries don't have the resources to necessarily support their populations. There's different cultural aspects of why people keep animals. So, some of the things like social standing, they, view animals more as like wealth rather than, something to feed them as a population. But other things are just, people don't have access to it. There's a lot of different supply chain things that go into people not being able to have food. Like if you're in a more remote area, there's like food deserts that don't allow you to have good access to food. Kind of a lot of different combinations that go into it. And it almost depends kind of where you are in the world that plays into what goes on there.
Yeah, and I know that there's some stuff too that, people don't have access to stuff that they can grow in like their certain climates. You can't grow, obviously corn and sand. And so there's all those different kinds of, climate related issues too. And I guess that kind of goes back to supply chain where, people can't, they have to ship in stuff that they can't get otherwise.
And I think it's important to note that diets are changing across the world as well. You're seeing a lot of proteins from animal sources is really increasing in developing countries. So in Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, more people are trying to get their protein from, instead of beans or lentils, they're trying to go into animal sources. And so it's really interesting to see how that impacts how those countries are using their resources and how industry is actually supporting it. I know that countries like Nestle are trying to really drive initiatives to help boost production of dairy products in China, for example. And so they're using their resources to really train farms to move from more of a subsistence approach to more of a actual approach to feed other people as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good topic to bring up. And also maybe switching gears a little bit here too, in my class, there's this article, probably the best one I've read yet. It's called Food Security, the Challenge of Feeding 9 Billion People. Obviously, we said between 9 and 10 billion, there's different estimates of what our population is going to be. And it's by Godfrey et al. It was published in 2010. Another thing, too, like in countries that are, I guess, less food secure, as people gain more money or, you know, have better income, they're able to purchase more food that, like meats and stuff like that, rather than relying on grain sources, that allows them to, you know, have more food and diversify their diet a little bit more also.
When you're feeding and changing your diet away from more of a cereals diet to more of an animal protein diet, that your food production is going to get less efficient. And that's been a challenge for many developing countries, since animal protein is only about a tenth as efficient in using land and water resources as is using animal protein, or using it to feed yourself off of cereal grains. So in several countries like that, that's been important and been a challenge really across the world.
Yeah, that's another thing to think about too, is like in those different, you know, kind of free market, you know, trades in countries like that, people, you know, grow a lot of their food for themselves. And so I think that that's something that, you know, especially, you know, countries with free trade where people can specialize and then create a market for different kinds of food, creates an opportunity where people, you know, don't have to worry so much about, you know, growing and sustaining, you know, several different types of crops. So I think that there's a lot of value in that conversation too.
I think as people are allowed to specify what they're growing and become more efficient, that helps greatly in their ability to produce and feed their population.
And the U.S. is, and other developed countries have played a huge role in that, specifying and really becoming more of feeding themselves and turning into an exporter in the global grain economy, and as well as in the protein economy. I mean, we are one of the main producers of corn and soybeans and wheat across the world. And so that allows us to try to help feed and, you know, feed animals and feed people across the world. And so our role, Brazil's role, Argentina and other countries like that, you know, the success of one is the success of many.
So, like, you know, we're talking about the specialization and people, you know, growing more for, you know, export and not so much just for themselves. But I think one of the problems that we kind of run into there is the fact that there is such large amounts going out. And I think that that might lead to a little bit of a problem with waste. So that's another thing that I think we want to talk about today.
Also mentioned recently, you know, 30 to 40% of the food produced each year, not just in the United States, but all over the world, is lost or wasted. So in the U.S., we have a big thing. I know sometimes myself, expiration dates are huge. We follow them kind of religiously sometimes, when in reality, you can usually, you know, a few days or even longer after your, you know, food expires or goes past a sell-by date, it's still fine. So that's kind of a really big thing, you know, our attitudes that go about how we think about our food and those dates that are on there kind of contributes to the food waste. And also, most of the food you see at the grocery store is going to be, you know, quote unquote, good looking. So it's going to be the best, you know, cream of the crop, whatever. So a lot of that before it gets to the grocery store is wasted also if it's not up to standards of what consumers in the United States are going to buy. And as we were kind of talking about before, too, in undeveloped countries, there's some issues with, you know, distribution, storage, harvesting. They don't necessarily have access to all the resources that we do here in the United States.
Yeah, and I would say that a large part of that food waste comes from a cultural thing. I think we live in such abundance in this country that we don't give it a second thought when we throw out, you know, bread that's a day past its expiration date, or, you know, when you don't finish your meal, it just feels okay to just scrape it off into the garbage. And I think that can sort of cause some sort of inequity in the fact that some people can just throw it out and there's food deserts elsewhere where people don't have high quality nutrition. And so I think that's something to consider.
When you were a kid, we were always, or at least I was always told by my parents that I had to finish my dinner plate because, you know, there's people that are less fortunate and, we don't want to waste food. But I wanted to know, did you also have that conversation? Kind of what were you taught when you were growing up?
Yeah, in my household, we had something called a happy plate, and you weren't allowed to leave the table until you made a happy plate.
Yeah, it was basically the same way in my house. I mean, especially growing up, you know, not so much in high school, but, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, you know, and me and my sister thought that, you know, we could do what we wanted. Mom and dad would make food, and, you know, sometimes it wouldn't be the best, but, you know, mom tried hard, so we ate it. But, you know, sometimes there'd be nights where, you know, my sister would, she would just not be having whatever, you know, mom cooked. And there was one night where she fell asleep at the dinner table because she did not want to eat that dinner. And yeah, that was a battle of will. So yeah.
Going back to the happy plate thing quick, if I can ask, is a happy plate an empty plate or what's the...
Yeah, it's empty. And usually the rule was you didn't get dessert unless you made a happy plate, which is funny because my family didn't usually even eat dessert with dinner. I guess my only reward is that I got to stand up from the table after I made a happy plate. That was all.
It was like more of a surprise though.
Yeah, right.
If you had a happy plate, there was a chance for dessert.
Right.
You know? So we could talk about how long we sat at the dinner table and, you know, refused to eat our mom's cooking for, you know, a while, I'm sure. But maybe we should look at, you know, maybe some ways that we could, you know, kind of address that problem of food waste. Yeah,
so like not trying to, you know, rehash the conversation we were having about finishing our dinner plate, but there's also, you know, restaurants at the end of the day, there's certain food regulation things that they have to abide by. So, you know, keeps everyone safe, but also there's a good chunk of food that does come out of, you know, restaurants every day that's prepared, they just don't use. So I don't necessarily have a lot of great ideas for that, but there's some things kind of, you know, the non-perishables that they could possibly use, or like the things that don't need to be refrigerated or are warm. You know, definitely there's food banks and stuff around that I think could benefit from that. But there's, you know, policies that are going to need to be changed in order to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I once worked at a buffet-style restaurant, and the amount of food waste was just insane. I mean, getting to the end of the day, and you're filling up 40-gallon garbage bags of food that I think could have really gone to better use. It's something that it's unfortunate, and I'm not really sure as how we can work around the food safety issue of that, but I wish there definitely was. We can get that food to people who need it.
I work at a restaurant in Madison, and there were some nights where like a big problem that we ran into is delivery orders that never got picked up. Those can't like go out of the window. Like, you know, they're just dead in the window. And there was one night where we filled up, like you were saying, like a 40-gallon like garbage bin of just like food. And it was just horrible because it's like, that's, you know, $400 worth of food that's literally just going straight in the trash. And so I think that that's just horrible to watch, especially, you know, during this conversation. Those are the kinds of things you think back on and you're like, wow.
On a more positive note, I know that the UW dining halls are actually doing something to combat this. They're taking all their leftover foods and they're able to freeze it and then give it out for free to students who come and grab it or who are in need. So that's a good plus that we have, and there's room for improvement there for everybody.
And I think, you know, the university has always been at the forefront of tackling issues like this. Obviously, it's different than a restaurant type setting where they're followed by regulations and, you know, they could lose that if they decided to not follow it.
Yeah, so we're talking about one of the big problems is food waste. And I think another thing that doesn't usually get brought up enough is problems with food availability. And, you know, supply chain has definitely been a buzzword in these last few months. But this has been a problem that's been ongoing for years, and you get to these inner cities where they don't have fresh produce at their stores. They have, you know, highly processed sugary cereals and things that just aren't very nutritious. It's crazy for me growing up where I could go to the grocery store, have really great produce that is blemish free, completely perfect on the shelves, and there are other places that don't have access to bananas or apples, just basic stuff that I think sometimes we take for granted. So much so that we throw out the produce that isn't completely perfect.
Yeah, and kind of going off of that, Egg, I mean, we live in Madison, you know, and most of us don't have cars, we're college kids, there's not a lot of parking around here. It's just one of those things that we deal with, but we have access to grocery stores like Target on State, and, you know, other places around that have fresh produce. But that's one thing that, like, you know, as we're having this conversation, that, you know, don't always think about is, you know, in the inner cities, it's a much larger span in between places that have fresh produce. And if you don't have a car, or if you don't have, you know, some way to, you know, be able to go to a, you know, a grocery store that has fresh produce, but not only that, bring it back. You know, it's hard to bring back 10 bags of groceries on a bus. So I think that that's something to think about too.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, you know, as students, we get, you know, a discounted bus pass and stuff like that to be able to go to these places, but also stores that know that students, you know, need these things can almost kind of do what they want with prices. So that's also kind of an interesting thing that we run into around here, as much as, you know, it is accessible to us. And also bus systems or whatever, depending on where you are too, aren't necessarily always going to be, you know, reliable. You might have to wait at the bus stop for an hour. I mean, it could be like a whole half day trip for you to just go 20 minutes up the road to a grocery store just because you don't have a car.
Not to mention you could be standing out there in negative 20 degree wind chills. Like, that just sucks.
And it's not fun at all. And it's, you know, it's hard to often equate that too, because if you want nutritious protein, it's going to be more expensive, or nutritious food in general. It's not as easy as going to McDonald's and feeling full off of, you know, 1,000 calories off of, you know, Happy Meal or whatever, but that's not really going to sustain you in the long run. And so when looking at that food insecurity, it's people have the money that they have, and they're going to choose something that's going to fill them up at the end of the day. And however they can get the most food for the least amount of money is a lot of times what people have to be forced into choosing.
Right. So, I mean, you know, based on what Galen said, it's not only distance that affects what, you know, really, you know, makes a food desert, it can be, you know, a combination of distance and price and, you know, just so many factors that we probably haven't even talked about too.
Yeah. And selection itself is a problem. When you have a decision to go to Taco Bell, McDonald's, or any other fast food restaurant, and the only grocery store that you have has the variety of food that you'd see at a BP convenience store, it's candy bars and chips, and it's just not nutritious food. So I think that there's a problem with all that. That comes from all of those factors.
Yeah, and kind of circling into a little bit of a different conversation too. So we have these like food insecurity issues, and there's different, you know, biotechnology and genetically, you know, genetic modification things that have been coming into the spotlight as a way of making our food more secure. But there's also some public like acceptance and trust in biotechnology that we could probably get into a whole conversation about for hours, but kind of, I don't know if anyone has any, you know, insights, thoughts about how these things have come into the spotlight of our society.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can, like you said, we could talk about GMOs and how they're, you know, viewed and everything like that for hours, because, you know, all of us here, we know enough about them to, I feel like, have an intelligent conversation. But one of the things that I think is really, really valuable about GMOs is the fact that, you know, countries that wouldn't normally be able to grow crops that, you know, we're fortunate enough to grow here, you know, in the Midwest, with GMOs, they're able to, you know, make them a little bit more vigorous, you know, and so they can grow in a harsher environment. And so I think that that's really cool. And that's a really, you know, proactive way that people could, you know, start to grow more diverse ranges of crops in different areas.
Yeah. And one of the problems that I think we're going to run into as the population increases is we need to make more food. And if we need to make more food, it means we have to use more inputs. And I think one of the big issues in the surrounding area of Madison, you get north into Portage County, is nitrogen leaching, because we have to supply so much nitrogen fertilizer. And I think GMOs are going to be a great way that we can reduce our inputs, leave less of a carbon footprint or a nitrogen footprint, whatever it may be, so that we can sort of balance it out.
Yeah, and speaking of kind of input of what we're putting into our environment and or just these ideas in general, there's going to be some investment in some infrastructure and stuff that's going to need to happen in order to make this occur, you know, not only in the United States, but also in some other countries around the world.
Yeah, especially in those third world countries or countries that are underdeveloped. The food that is produced there, there's a lot of problems getting it harvested or getting it transported and stored. So it doesn't always get up, end up on the plate of those who want to consume it. And that's a big issue that they're facing.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, that's where a lot of our crops are going to have to end up going, because as cities, you know, grow in mass, and, you know, as more people move into cities and, you know, suburbs start to take over more of the really precious farmland that we have, especially here in the Midwest, that's another thing where, you know, GMOs are going to come in handy, because they're going to have to move out to those places where, you know, we wouldn't normally think that crops would be grown.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've been, you know, driving outside of Madison on my way home, and, you know, I see, like, I feel like I see a new apartment building going up every day, because we need to be able to, you know, sustain the people that need to move to this area, or, you know, move to any area really, to be able to have a job and stuff like that. But also we need to be mindful also of kind of the farmland that is going to be used to make this.
And I know by 2050, I mean, we really talk about how do we use fringe acres that may not be in cultivation or frequently in cultivation, and how do we expand those acres so that they can be used sustainably for throughout time. And as I think about it, we talk about how, you know, urban sprawl is impacting, you know, life here in the United States. But I think in developing countries as well, as you're really seeing that, you know, one example would be Brazil. You're seeing a lot of sprawl into some of those traditional agricultural lands. And then that forces them, as they're trying to ramp up their production and feed their people and feed the rest of the world, to go into the rainforest and go into areas where they're fringe, and maybe they weren't thinking about using it for production agriculture, but they have to really alter that landscape in order to use it for cultivation.
You know, we're not just losing more farmland, but something that is going to help that is kind of the rise of urban agriculture, whether it's community gardens or growing crops on tops of roofs. It makes a difference, and it also leads to kind of more education about what goes into agriculture.
Right, and I think that this can solve a few issues. We talked about food deserts before. If they're growing their own produce, that no longer becomes a problem. It provides access to these communities. Also, I think there has been a trend in the past, and it continues today, of as the population grows, the proportion of people who are growing our food who are involved in agriculture is shrinking steadily. And I think that as people move to the cities and away from rural areas and get away from agriculture, that they still have their hand in food production, whether that be through community gardens, urban agriculture, whatever it is. And I think that can really help out with some of these food waste problems and food access problems that we've seen.
Yeah, and kind of going off of that too, I mean, if people understand what goes into, you know, kind of growing crops and, you know, growing their own produce, even if it is, you know, just some tomatoes on a roof or something, they still understand that there's a process that goes into growing everybody's food, and it doesn't happen overnight, and they understand that it's really not easy. Like, you know, you can grow a tomato on a roof, but I mean, it takes a while. You know, you gotta, you know, put shade over them and stuff, I think. I don't know. But, you know, it's not easy. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of to add into that conversation about everyone having, you know, a hand in our food production is, you know, how many of us, you know, in this house or in this room right now necessarily might have not grown up on a farm? You know, I certainly didn't. But kind of understanding what goes into our food and even having roots in that still allows us to have some education and be able to educate other people about what goes into our food.
Yeah, and I think we talk a lot about how people typically say, oh, 1-2% of people are actually active farming within the United States. And when you look at the broader scope of people that are involved in the food and fiber chain to get a product to a consumer that's going to use it or eat it or whatever, that number grows exponentially, and almost a quarter of our people in the United States, or at least a fifth, are involved in that process of taking a raw product and turning it into a consumable good. And so kind of broadening people's understanding of where they can fit into that, whether it's, you know, stocking grocery shelves or working with ag equipment or anything like that, is really important.
Kind of, you know, taking a little bit of different perspective about this conversation too, is in recent years we've heard a lot about, well, you know, animal production and agriculture in general accounts for a lot of the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And we kind of want to talk about, like, yes, it does have a little bit of, you know, an effect, but the other sectors in the United States that play a bigger role in greenhouse gas emissions is, you know, something that needs to be talked about. And, you know, we're going to need to work together between these different entities to change that.
I know, especially you look at animal agriculture, this next decade is really going to be about sustainability, and that's really something that goes hand in hand with greenhouse gas emissions. A lot of bigger production facilities are going into carbon sequestration into the soil, as well as methane digesters and compressed natural gas bottling facilities.
Yeah, so I actually had the opportunity to work at a dairy that used a methane digester and really tried to control their food waste, because they were also using some of their waste products from cheese production back on their dairy. And so it's really an interesting process to see how this whole idea of limiting waste has been maturing over the last years. This dairy, they used their production facility to harvest that methane into a commodity that they could sell back to the grid. And then they used the solids from that process of drying down manure to bed their cows. And so processes like these have been expanding in recent years, and they're no way from being close to completed. But using everybody kind of taking that opportunity to really concentrate and limit their waste has been really influential in cutting back some of the carbon that we see in the atmosphere.
Yeah, you know, you watch some of these documentaries about the food system, and I think it kind of paints agriculture, especially animal agriculture, in a negative light when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. But I think we're seeing a lot of trends that are, I think, should be cause for hope and optimism. One such trend that I've noticed is the farm table kind of trend that's been going on. People are getting their food from more local sources, so there isn't that big, long, stretched out chain where people are trucking animals, you know, clear across the country, and there's not a lot of transportation going into it. One example that I've seen with this is we have to wait close to a year and a half in order to get our beef processed at the butcher, because they are so backed up, because people are more and more moving towards getting their food sourced from places that they know. And I think that is definitely cause for optimism.
Yeah, and that definitely plays into the conversation about, we had pretty early in the podcast too, about how as income in, you know, our country and around the world increases too, you have more disposable income to spend on things like, you know, meat that you know where it's coming from and stuff like that, rather than buying it from the grocery store, you know, those farm to table ideas.
So while, you know, kind of a farm to table, it works really well on a small scale, I think that, you know, there is still a lot of food that needs to be produced that can't be produced the way that it is in that, you know, kind of example.
Agree. You know, I think that's one part of the pie. I think there's a lot of this is a multifaceted issue that a lot of different, there's a lot of solutions that need to be put into. You were going to talk about a little bit about vertical integration and how that can better support feeding people while also reducing our emissions.
Yeah, absolutely. Because yeah, the thing about vertical integration is that the way it works is that these companies, you know, own a lot, all the aspects from you know, the plant where it's, you know, processed, to the farms, to even the land that some of the feed is grown on. And so when all of that works together, you have much, much better, you know, efficiency ratings and stuff, because those, you know, owners of those companies and stuff and those managers, they can work with each other because they're in the same company. You know, they can see where they need to improve. And I think that that's really valuable too.
And I think you can see vertical integration outside of the, you know, the big four and the meat packing or anything like that. You can see vertical integration on a smaller scale, especially in the dairy market, utilizing your ability to make cheese on a smaller scale from one farm or a group of farms, rather than maybe selling to a DFA or another type of processor like that. And so vertical integration sometimes gets a rap that's, you know, more about consolidation of agriculture. And I still think there are opportunities for vertical integration to take place on a smaller scale to feed more people while still making a competitive market that's not going to give anybody the short end of the stick, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, even on that small scale, there's, you know, still just amazing gains to be had for efficiency because, you know, like I said, you can plan the whole way through. So,
yeah. And I think that all of these parts kind of feed into how we're going to feed the population as it continues to grow. Things like vertical integration, some people doing the farm to table thing is only one part of it. Limiting our food waste, all these other things that go into solving this question of how are we going to feed the growing population.
Yeah, as you were saying, there's not going to be just one way to do this. It's going to take a lot of people working together, a lot of efforts, you know, all simultaneously, that we're going to be able to get to this idea of, you know, net zero or feeding 9 to 10 billion people by that year 2050.
I suppose to wrap everything up today, it's been good to really talk about the fact that to solve food security issues and to really solve the problem of feeding more people as we move forward as a society, it's more than just a producer issue or a consumer issue. There are aspects that we can have as producers, consumers, and on the legislative side to really tackle this. And so going anywhere from addressing food waste at the grocery store level to optimizing production systems really has a benefit in tackling this issue.
You can connect with us on Facebook at the Association of Women in Agriculture, on Instagram at AWA_UW Madison, and listen to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Thank you for listening.
Rush AGR.